Tell me about your trip to Iraq. You traveled to there this last January, is that correct?
That's right. Well, obviously, when I went to Iraq, this was my first trip there. I wasn't sure what to expect. I'd done a little bit of research, about the situation. One of the things that concerned me is, well, how are the Iraqi people going to treat me? I mean, here are these people that our government says they're our enemy. These people that have been suffering ever since the Gulf War under economic sanctions. Let me give you just an example of what that suffering is like, is that the economic sanctions up through 1996 prevented even the importation of food and basic medicine. The rates of malnutrition and preventable diseases, dysentery, cholera, typhoid, escalated tremendously. They kept getting worse. One quarter of all Iraqi children in 1998 were moderately to severely malnourished. One half of all pregnant women were anemic. 30% of all babies born had very low birth weight. The incidence of cancers, leukemia, birth defects, gross malformations, 5 to 7 times the rate from 1990. More than 1.5 million Iraqi people have died unnecessarily. Now, that's not the government of Iraq talking. This is World Health Organization. This is UNICEF. Studies in the New England Journal of Medicine. So as I went to Iraq, you know, here's people that there's hardly a family there that doesn't have first-hand experience of this kind of suffering. How would they treat me? What it turns out is they treated me with generosity and kindness. They were open-hearted. They welcomed me. You'd go into a store. You might go into a marketplace. As a foreigner, you always stand out. They know who you are. But they're not quite sure why you're there, and so they kind of look at you a little funny. We had a sheet that was written on one side English and one side Arabic that explained what the Iraq peace team was and why we're there. And many people in Baghdad, in the, you know, the city itself, speak a little bit of English, you know, a few words. People learn it in school. It's a required course from 5th grade on. But they'd kind of look at you, and they wanted to know why you were there, and you'd hand them this sheet of paper. We called it the magic sheet because it really was. They'd start reading the Arabic side, and this change would come over their face. This huge smile. They'd come over, they'd shake your hand, they'd say, "Come, sit next to me here in the store." And then they'd go out on the street and get you tea. There's all these little tea stands, you know, about 2 in every block along the way. And they'd come and bring you tea. And they'd say, "Thank you so much for being here." And just beside yourself with saying, "I can hardly imagine having a warmer welcome."
How were the peace teams structured in terms of seeing what was going on in Iraq? Did you have a set schedule?
It was actually a mixed schedule. We had specific organized events that we'd go visiting to government agencies. We would visit, like, the UN agencies in Iraq. We'd go to hospitals. We'd go to, like, water treatment plants that had been bombed. We went to places that had sustained bombing both during the Gulf War and then also in 1998 with what was called Operation Desert Fox, where we bombed Iraq again. We also had a lot of free time, So part of it was, you know, we could go out and we could wander the streets during the day and we could meet people in their stores and in marketplaces, public places, where we found people that could speak English. We could, you know, ask them pretty much whatever we wanted. So a lot of it was really gathering information. You might say bearing witness to what life is really like for Iraqis right now.
I have to imagine for them, a lot of them are aware, perhaps more than Americans, of how close we are to potential increase of U.S. military action there.
Of course.
So did you have conversations with people about that directly?
Yeah, I did. That was one of the things that I was really interested to know about, is how do you deal with something like that? What do you tell your children? Do you talk about it in your family? And what I found was that basically people are pretty fatalistic about it. They know the threat of war. They also know firsthand what the consequences of that will be. But it's like they say, what choice have we got? It's not up to us. They'd say, have we talked about it in our families? Sure, we've talked about it. But it's like, well, what can we do? Can we leave the country? Well, no, we don't have resources for that. Most people in Iraq are rather desperately poor. Well, should we find somebody in our family with a car and we all go out to the countryside where it might be less likely to be subject to bombing? And do what? If we go with our family to the countryside, you know, it's not like we're going to leave any money or valuables at home unprotected. We're obviously going to have them with us. And everybody else will know that we have it with us. And so we'll be vulnerable to virtually anybody with a gun. No, about the only choice that families would have would to say, well, there's going to be some families that will survive. Maybe we'll be one of them. What else can we do? Are the kids afraid? Sure they are. But once you've made the decision to stay put, what more do we have to talk about?
As a witness and a citizen here of the U.S., did you find a lot of people approaching you to be a ambassador, a communicator to our leaders in Washington?
There were a number of people that said, we do have a message for American people. They said, we want you to tell them that we do not hate Americans. And everything I saw reflected, in fact, they were very sincere in that. They make a real clear distinction between the American government and the American people. They said, we do not hate American people. We admire American people. We'd like things to be more like America here, as a matter of fact. Many people said, yeah, we'd like things to be different here. Sometimes they'd even mention Saddam Hussein. They'd say, would we prefer something different? Say, yeah, sure. But every single person I talked to would also say, but you know, that's our problem. We need to be the ones to work for change. Everyone said, no, we do not want anyone to impose a change from outside.
Tell me about some of the incidents that stand out in your mind, some of those things that I will never forget, this or that.
Certainly one of the things, on two occasions, I visited hospitals in Iraq. I mentioned already that the rate of cancers and leukemia, birth defects, is 5 to 7 times higher today than it was in 1990. There's a lot of speculation as to what might have caused this dramatic increase. One of the possibilities is that it has to do with depleted uranium. Depleted uranium is used in the construction of artillery shells, bullets and bombs that's intended to be armor-piercing, bunker-piercing. It's a very dense metal, and that it has like about twice the penetrating power of lead. So it's preferred by many in the military because it artillery shell can go all the way through a tank and out the other side. Now, one of the problems with depleted uranium is that, in fact, it's still radioactive to a small degree. On impact, there's a tremendous amount of heat that's generated. And so the metal actually, a part of it, vaporizes. It combines with the surrounding air, creating oxides, and ends up being like a dust, a very fine dust. Well, that dust is in the soil, and it gets blown in the air for literally hundreds of miles. Now, from studies that have been done here in the United States, veterans' hospitals have found evidence of depleted uranium in GIs from 10 years ago, and it's still there. Is this the cause of the greatly increased cancers, leukemia, birth defects? Well, it's not been proven one way or another. But it's a big suspect because we know that anything radioactive in very small doses is carcinogenic. I might mention that if, in fact, that is the reason, the use of depleted uranium by the United States is a crime of war. It's contrary to the Geneva Conventions. So I went to the hospitals, the pediatric hospitals, and we went to the wards where the children with the cancers and leukemia were. One of the things that, see, right now, because the Oil for Food program has expanded over the years, actually the things like the malnutrition and the basic medicines have gotten better in the last about 2 years, so that the rates of malnutrition and preventable diseases have stopped getting worse anyway, and there may be some indication they may actually be getting a little better. But that's not true for cancers. The equipment that's needed and the medicines that are needed, you know, we have, if you have cancer here, you get radiation therapy, you get chemotherapy. Well, anything that has to do with radiation or, you know, chemicals of that sort are still prohibited under the economic sanctions. So they can't import those, the equipment that would be necessary to do it. So if you have cancers, leukemia, that sort of thing in Iraq right now, there is no help. You die. And that's the situation for these kids. They have tumors. I just got an email from a person on the Iraq Peace Team this last week. The Iraq Peace Team has started a program of going into the hospitals and just doing things like arts and crafts with the kids, things that don't rely on much language because most of us don't speak any Arabic. And they were talking about one young person. I think they were about 6 years old. And he has a tumor, you know, about the size of a grapefruit on his stomach. Causes him a lot of pain. There's nothing to be done about that. And they talked with the mother. It's an interesting thing. In the Iraqi hospitals, the parents stay with the children in the hospital. They actually have a bed right next to theirs. And so the parents actually provide a lot of the care and the support, something I wish maybe we'd think about here in the United States, as a matter of fact. But because there aren't really enough nurses and there are not enough doctors to go around, and in fact, because they don't have any way of curing the cancers, about all you can do is to try and ease the pain and the suffering. Well, they were talking with this woman who's the mother of this young boy who has the cancers. She's already had 4 children die of cancer since the Gulf War. This is her 5th to die. That's... It's really hard for me to recognize that our U.S. foreign policy relies on hunger and disease as part of our tools of our foreign policy. It's not really something I can accept. But it's there. And one of the really powerful things about that experience is you know that they know how the Gulf War and the economic sanctions have affected them. They know you came from the United States, and when you go in there, they welcome you. The kids smile at you. They want you to take their pictures. They're glad that you're there. One of the things I learned when I was in Iraq was the fact that things are different now than they were in 1991 when the first Gulf War was happening. In 1990, Iraq was actually a reasonably prosperous country. Very strong middle class. People had jobs, they had income, they had some savings, they had some resources to fall back on. So when you had the war, the Gulf War, they could survive for a while, you know, based on the resources they had. Well, they don't have that anymore. The people are impoverished. Right now, people survive because they get food rations from the government of Iraq. These food rations, for 80% of the population, is like 2/3 to 3/4 of the amount of food they have available to them. Obviously, that's, you know, it's not everything, right? But if there's a war, if there's an attack, that system of food distribution will be broken down. It won't happen. Then what happens to the Iraqi people? What happens is, according to the United Nations, more than 10 million will need to be fed. They won't have enough food. More than 2 million will be homeless. More than 1 million children are at risk of death due to malnutrition and starvation. Those are the consequences of war. Those are the people that pay. Not Saddam Hussein, not the ruling party, but the Iraqi people. That's why it's really important for us right now. I truly believe that the only thing that is standing in the way of war right now is the American people. I was so heartened, you know, on February 15th, when we all went out in the streets and we demonstrated, we marched. We got counted. We stood up and we said publicly, we oppose this war. At least 20,000 in the city of Seattle, hundreds of thousands in other cities in this country, New York, San Francisco, millions throughout the world. So we've been counted. We've been there. And that was so heartening to me. But that in itself is not going to prevent the war. Now, I know there's groups here in Seattle, there's groups nationwide that say, we have emergency response planning. When the bombs start dropping, here's what we're going to do. And so there's actions that will take place on the day of the bombing, the day after the bombing. That's too late. Once the bombing starts, the consequences for the people of Iraq will already be happening. The published war plans, it's been in the papers, is to drop anywhere, you know, I see different reports, different numbers, anywhere from 800 to 3,000 bombs and missiles each day for the first 3 days of the war. More bombs and missiles than the entire Gulf War of 1991 combined in those first 3 days. Most of those bombs will be on Baghdad, Baghdad is a city of 4.5 million people. If we wait for the bombs to start dropping before we react, it's too late. It's not going to stop for those first 3 days. So whatever you might be thinking about for when you hear the bombs starting to drop, do that today. Do it tomorrow. That's when the action is needed. In a sense, this is kind of counterintuitive. It means you've got to think about what the consequences of war really are. When the bombs start dropping, we're going to all have just tremendous hurt and grief, knowing how badly the people of Iraq are suffering. And there'll be a lot of energy with that. And so, you know, this isn't to say that actions at that time aren't appropriate, but I'm saying it's not a matter of stopping the war. We have to prevent it. So that's why we have to act now. Whatever you would do, it's time for civil disobedience. It's time for us to say, you cannot have business as usual. Not when business as usual means war.
What else is important to get out to people?
Certainly the need for action. For myself, I'm taking a leave of absence from my job for the month of March. I really expect that something's going to be happening during that month of March, one way or another. Wednesday, I'm going to be flying to Washington, D.C., with the intent of coordinating vigils and civil disobedience in front of the White House. Now, I'm going to Washington, D.C. because it's symbolic. One of the things I'm going to be trying to do is that there is quite a number of people that have gone to Iraq through Voices in the Wilderness, and I'm going to be contacting them and asking them to come to Washington, D.C. also. I want to talk to the president. We've been in Iraq. We have a certain perspective. And I want him to know that. I don't expect that George will be real happy to see us. And so, for me, I suspect that would be the focus of any civil disobedience that I would do. I won't take no for an answer. I also have some pictures of people in Iraq. These are the people that will bear the consequences of any war. I want to have those pictures of the people of Iraq surrounding the White House. I want people to know, from my being in Iraq, okay, it's not the subjective thing of the Iraqi people. It's like, these are people I talked with. I shook their hand. I looked them in the eye. We talked together. So it's personal. These are people who are going to die. And with these pictures, I hope that it becomes personal for other people. You look at those pictures and you say, how can we even think of hurting these people, these children, these older people? They look like my neighbors. That's exactly the point. They do look like your neighbors. You'd be glad to have them as neighbors. There's a lot of people depending on us right now. Certainly the 25 million people in Iraq. They're depending on us to prevent this war. There's the 50 people that are in Iraq right now for Voices in the Wilderness. People from the United States and Canada, primarily. That are there for the duration. They're depending on us as well. There's another group. There are 180,000 young American men and women in the Gulf right now. They are willing to risk their lives to carry out the policies of our government. What more could we ask of them? But it's up to us to make sure that the policies of our government do not include war. I am also concerned about 300 million American people. If we don't know it now, we will know it. Might be years from now, but we will know the true humanitarian disaster that we have created, that we are responsible for. What will we have to do to ourselves to try and avoid knowledge of that? When our children or our grandchildren ask us, how could it have been possible for our country to do such things? I think right now we should try to figure out, how are we going to answer that? If our children and grandchildren ask us, what did you do to prevent this war? I think we should ask ourselves that right now. Try and figure out, how are we going to answer that? You know, there's a lot of people that say, we need to support our troops. Yes, we do. I hope those people will also talk to the troops that served in the Gulf War. And how did that experience affect them? The United States and other countries committed war crimes during that war. 1/3 of all veterans of the Gulf War now have disability of one kind or another, both physical and psychological, and have applied for disability. We don't hear much about that. I want to support our troops. The best way to support our troops is to oppose a policy of war.